Hey, thanks for dropping by. Come on in.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
You know, I've got to confess something. Whenever someone tells me they're going overseas and I ask them where they're going and they say Bali, I can't, and every time I'll do this, I can't help but say, why don't you go overseas? Because I just don't think it counts. I'm sorry if you've been to Bali and you think that I'm being snobbish or whatever, then yes, I am, and I stand by it. But I'm raising this because I want to have a conversation today about Asia and our relationship to it, and we have a lot of different ways of relating to it, business, politics, and especially tourism, which brings us all the way back to Bali. And Indonesia particularly, this befuddling country, is the subject of a new book, a wonderfully titled new book by one of my guests in the drawing room tonight. It's called Indonesia Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation. Elizabeth Pisani is the author of it, and she's been good enough to drop by, along with Dr. Agnieszka Sobocinska, who is the Deputy Director of the National Centre for Australian Studies at Monash University, and she herself is the author of a book called Visiting the Neighbours, Australians in Asia. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Indonesia's not a country, really, is it?
It's been trying quite hard to be, but the clue is in the title of my book, The Improbable Nation. It's deeply improbable and has been so since it came into being on the 17th of August, exactly 69 years ago, with the Declaration of Independence, which reads, in its entirety,
yes,
we the people declare the independence of the Republic of Indonesia. The details of the transfer of power, etc., will be worked out as soon as possible.
That's a brilliant. Is that the best Declaration of Independence in history?
And it's the whole thing. And it's fantastic because they really have been working on the etc.s ever since. and in fact, they're doing quite a good job now. They've cobbled together quite a workable democratic nation, but it's taken a while. On the issue of is Bali part of Indonesia, I just have to draw attention to the world's global bank, HSBC, which assaults you at every airport around the world, telling you how very global they are.
Yes, indeed. And how many planes are in the sky at any given moment and all of that sort of thing, yeah.
There was a letter in a UK paper recently from someone who was a bit disappointed because he'd telephoned HSBC to tell them that he was going overseas. Please don't cancel my cards. And blow me, they cancelled his cards. And he called up and said, what's that about? And they said, well, you know, you said you were going to Bali and then we saw that there were transactions from Indonesia. So
oh, <yeah. laughs>
that's fantastic.
Are you serious? Is my criticism of the travel habits of people going to Bali legitimate? Have you been?
I have. And it's interesting when you're looking at the history of Australians in Asia because that in itself is a really fascinating reaction and response to Bali. I mean, Australians have sort of in the past been noted to be afraid of Asia and see it as a sort of big other place.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden they go to Bali and they feel so at home that it becomes a sort of Australian space and it's been called another state of Australia and a little Australia. And if you look at it in the long term, that's fascinating.
We need to be clear because Bali is itself diverse, and so there are parts of it that are far more like the Gold Coast, just
the
a bit further north,
parts
and
of Bali,
all of that sort of thing. So, is that a microcosm of the way we think about and interact with Australia, with Asia?
With Asia, well, I mean, the way that we, you know, in inverted commas, interact with Asia is so complicated, and it has been complicated over more than 100 years. Australians have been going to Asia for a very long time, but the fact that almost 1 million Australians are expected to go this year, and most Australians have been to Asia in the last few years, over a third have been to Bali alone, makes it a pretty important experience in the way that Australians think about it. More than a third of Australians have been to Bali.
I've given a couple of talks at the wonderful Melbourne Writers Festival recently, and each time I ask people, you know, so who here's been to Indonesia, stick your hand up, and, you know, maybe a third of hands go up, probably more in this audience. And then I say, and, you know, keep your hand up if you've been anywhere except Bali. And we're down to one or two, and then keep your hands up if you've been anywhere except Bali or Java, which are two of the 13,500 islands that make up Indonesia.
They're pretty big ones, though. I mean, Java's a fairly significant part.
Well, it's 7% of the land mass, so it's not that. It's exactly twice the size of Tasmania, and it has 370 times as many people packed into it. So it's the population that makes Java important. And its political position.
Right, because Jakarta is,
And some Indonesians feel that they have been subject to Javanese colonization, essentially, for many years. That's part of the etc.
And it's the dizzying diversity of this place. This is why I sort of opened up with, is this even a country? There's a bigger question behind that, which is what exactly constitutes a country? When is something really a country and not, are countries not just all fictions in this way? But Indonesia is so incoherent. in so many ways.
Yeah, well, it's an accident of Dutch cupidity, really. It's an accident of a bunch of very wily merchants in the essentially the 16th, 17th centuries who wanted to corner the market for spices in the Western world. And actually, Indonesia's given us, it was the first great multinational, the Dutch East Indies Company. It was indeed the first joint stock company. It gave us the first stock exchange in the world, the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, which was created specifically to trade shares in the enterprise of what has become Indonesia.
Yeah.
So it has a long and illustrious history of banditry and bad behavior. It went bankrupt, then became too big to fail, had to be bailed out by the Dutch crown. It's a notion, but it's a notion with a history that has quite a lot of resonances in today's barbarous globalized economic world.
Mm. Quite a contentious notion, though.
But you bring up a pretty good point there in itself, Ali, the fact of what is a nation, who are, you know, even when I'm looking at Australians in Asia, the idea of Australians going to Asia, two more problematic sort of categories you can hardly find. So I think the same problems arise looking at Australians, a nation of migrants going to Asia. I mean, what in the name is Asia?
So an Australian who holds Australian citizenship of Chinese extraction, who's lived in Australia for, what's the minimum, 5 years, I think, or whatever it is before you get citizenship, who goes to Beijing.
Absolutely.
And is that an Australian in Asia?
Exactly. I mean, I was born in Poland and I've been writing about this for a decade now, so look at the questions of that. But the idea of Australians of Chinese heritage going to, you know, back in inverted commas is absolutely fascinating. Look at someone like, for example, Kylie Kwong, one of our celebrity chefs here in Australia, and she trades on the fact that she's sort of, you know, a hybrid of both Chinese and Australian, but she's fifth generation Australian with a great-grandfather who was born in China. She doesn't speak Mandarin, so going back becomes so psychologically problematic in that case.
I do have to say that it's more legitimate if you're a chef than almost anything else. My last name is Pisani, which is a good Italian name. I speak several languages, but Italian is not one of them. My father didn't speak Italian, even though both of his parents were direct immigrants. But the one thing that has come down is the cooking.
Really?
You know, yeah, the only part of the Italian heritage that has persisted in our family in any way
is in
the kitchen. My grandmother, so it tends to come through the maternal, it comes through the mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's from Sicily.
Right.
So I think that it's really interesting the way your cultural roots imprint themselves, and language is obviously one way, but we tend to... I remember years ago going to Melbourne Cemetery and being completely fascinated. It's absolutely fascinating, that place, because first of all, it's many different denominations and faiths. Mm. But also, you see these sort of family plots, and the first people are Giuseppe and Carmelina, you know, and their sons, Joe and Carmi, and their grandson, there's Kylie and Kevin, you know.
Roger and Dave. And
exactly. There's this progressive Australianization of names on gravestones in family plots, which I think tells you about how we sort of lose our culture as immigrants over time.
But it's interesting because food and travel are also one of the easiest things that are picked up. So in my book, I trace how travel has this influence on Australia, when what travellers bring back. And yeah, food is often one of the first things. So, you know, hippies in the 60s and 70s were bringing back things like dal and yoga, the sorts of, you know, aesthetics as well of Asia. And that's what they were taking out first of all. And then how multiculturalism sort of plays on that and how it builds on that is an interesting question, but it is an easy sort of thing to uptake. Food definitely is an easy one.
So this is the point that you, one of the many points you're making in the book, is that you have Australia today as being a composite of many things, including our interaction with Asia, our experiences with Asia. What is the Asian content of this thing called Australia and Australianness? I don't mean in composition and demographic terms, but at a deeper level than that.
Well, it's seen as this very important construct. I mean, if you look at politics today, just as it has been over the past century, Asia is a huge question that's constantly being tossed up and discussed. Look at Clive Palmer last week. Look at politics any day of the week. The idea that Australia's future is going to be in some way or form shaped by Asia, but also that we have no past with Asia, so that there's, you know, it's a big open question as to how we're going to confront it. So what I try to do in this book is actually look at who has been there, Australians that have been to Asia before, how they've faced it, how they've sort of behaved there, how they've interacted with people in Asia, to sort of see, well, actually, no, it's not this sort of empty past, it's just a thing that's going to be there in the future. Australians have been interacting with the region for well over a century.
But are you talking about Australians who go to Asia or Australians who come from Asia?
Oh, both, absolutely. In the political conversation, though, that's often forgotten.
Yeah.
So, the idea of Australians, which I raised before, is this very problematic question. Who are Australians, especially when they go to Asia?
Well, I mean, if you look at the old crocodiles who are, at the heads of all the political parties, you would think that they're all boat people from Europe, aren't they?
Well, from about 200 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a regular criticism that's made of our parliament, is that it's not remotely reflective of the demographics of the country.
So why is it? It's a democracy, so you theoretically ought to be able to vote for something that looks more like you.
Are you asking questions about structural racism? Is that what you're suggesting?
Just saying.
Just saying. Indeed. But the question that you raise about what is Australia is interesting. But what is also interesting is the question about what is Asia.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think in the Australian imagination, Asia is actually a fairly narrow concept. We don't go very far west with it.
No, although it has changed a little bit over time. I mean, so in the 19th and early 20th centuries, if you talked about Asia or the Orient or the East, it was sort of this amalgam of China, Japan, parts of India. And then, yeah, it sort of changed so that by the time Pauline Hanson spoke about it in the late 90s, she talked of Australia being swamped by Asians at the time. It was popularly understood that she was talking about East and Southeast Asians, whereas in England, for example, if you talked about Asians, you're most likely going to be, conjuring
South
an
Asia.
Image of South Asians, yeah. Exactly.
So and no one's including, like, the Gulf.
No.
So, I mean, except for FIFA, no one seems to think about Asia is extending to the Middle East.
And the big question in Australia has often been, is Australia a part of Asia? So geographically, right. Is it defined as part of Asia? Culturally, is it defined as part of Asia? And more increasingly, demographically, is it a part of Asia? And so this is
And the answer to that is certainly no anywhere in the world except for Australia. I mean, how it's defined in Australia, I don't know, but outside of Australia, there is no part of the world that I am aware of
that thinks
of Australia as part of Asia.
Can I play the FIFA card yet again? Because FIFA clearly think that Australia is part of it. We weren't about 8 years ago, but we are now.
Right. And we know that FIFA, talking about, unrepresentative bodies that are...
what, who merely declare things to be true? Yes, there you go. Therefore, it's true. But I also think economists might think of Australia very much as part of Asia. So I think it depends a bit on how it is you understand what the nation is and where it belongs. The Australian economic story is an Asian economic story, surely.
Absolutely. And also raises broader points about what leads these sort of discussions to what extent does culture actually lead politics? So if things like FIFA, football federations or sport or culture, where does politics go? It often takes its markers from culture. There's a lot of history that's being written which is saying actually, cultural diplomacy and the spread of sport and the spread of food is the first step in political international relations. So
are we going to have to give up pandas?
Well, no, you don't have to. We just become part of Asia. It's fine. That's the way it works. I feel like you're making a point about Israel and Eurovision somewhere in there, but I can't quite figure out where it sits. That's the voice of Dr. Agnieszka Sobocinska, who is the author of a book called Visiting the Neighbours, Australians in Asia, which, as she's now admitted, is, a title that doesn't mean that much because we can't figure out what Australians are or Asia is. Anyway, she's the Deputy Director of the National Centre for Australian Studies. Elizabeth Persani, my other guest in the drawing room, the author of Indonesia, Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation. Do you always go to cemeteries?
Yes.
Why?
I think you learn a lot from them. Of course, you learn something about, I have a hidden and not very glorious past as a demographer.
Oh.
That was one of my many mishap degrees. Mm-hmm. I'm actually interested in what you learn from how people record their past in terms of dead people.
Dead people are important though, aren't they? Who we decide we are. And who we decide other people are.
I think so. And I think, and particularly how we decide to memorialise dead people.
Yeah.
That reflects back on who we are.
Because I wonder, Agnieszka, if Australia's Asianness or lack thereof in the eyes of ourselves or indeed the rest of the world, if Elizabeth's assessment is correct, is about who's died here.
I think in a sense, the question of who we memorialise and who what we think is important in our past is absolutely a key issue. Next year, the centenary of the Anzac landing is going to be a big moment.
Yeah.
When we memorialise what it was to become, to be Australian, what it is to be part of this nation. And interestingly, I mean, the Chinese Museum here in Melbourne has exhibitions on Chinese Anzacs. So there's been a lot of work done on Indigenous Anzacs. So Australia's war past, you know, people who died for Australia in war, once you start to sort of open up those borders a little bit, you find Australians there of all sorts of extractions and ethnic backgrounds. So absolutely.
Well, that's one of the most complicating factors of any military history as well, and who gets included in that history and who doesn't. And the most chilling example I can think of, which is unfortunately the only one that's coming to mind, is the history of Jewish soldiers in the German army and the role that they played in World War One, and then what ultimately happened to their people, their children, going into World War Two after all that sacrifice. So there's this kind of selective telling of history and who it is that's in and out.
Absolutely. And the story of Australian POWs, of the Japanese during the Second World War, again, the questions of culpability and sort of who's responsible, and are the Japanese in the post-war period, you know, the same Japanese who are doing this in the wartime period.
Yeah.
So again, it is very complicated, and we're talking about some dark pasts, but past that it's worth asking questions about nonetheless.
Notwithstanding all of that, would you, either of you, describe Australia's relationship with, say, Indonesia, or just with Asia generally, as being somewhat miraculous, in that we share so much history that is dark, and yet we have great trading relationships, and it seems, I don't know if you could say we're best friends necessarily, but we're becoming warmer.
I think certainly pragmatic. Miraculous might be going a bit far.
I think miraculous to the extent that it's often forgotten. I mean, the extent of these connections, the idea that, you know, this is something new in Australia's sort of contemporary place, that we're only now engaging with Asia. I think it's miraculous how much is papered over and how much has been forgotten.
In that we've been engaging for a long time.
We have been engaging with Asia for such a long time. The same stories that are being told today were being told well over 100 years ago, you know, that Asia is just over the horizon, that we have to engage with this region. You're right, Australia's sort of economic engagement has been going on for a much longer time. So I'm not sure if it's miraculous, because I think there are reasons why Australians tend to paper over that Asian history, but it's shocking nonetheless.
I think also that democracies tend to have a very short memory, and every incoming campaign, every incoming government puts it back on the agenda. This is going to be the Asian century. This is going to be... And I was reporting on from Indonesia 25 years ago, and at that time, the Australian government was saying, you know, Asia facing, actually it was when Gareth Evans was foreign minister, you know, we're facing Asia, and we're, it seemed new at the time. And then for a new generation, you hear it again now and you think, oh yeah, we're going to turn and face Asia. Turn from where?
Absolutely.
Actually, you've been facing Asia more or less for a long time.
I think that's actually a large part of the problems. As you say, the politicians who decide to brand it as sort of their own policy and their own campaign have led to this sort of forgetting over and over again, which is why I think it is important to sort of look at the history of ordinary people, ordinary Australians travelling to Asia, to find that hidden history.
Can I just ask, you know, when you were writing the book and you were speaking to Asian Australians, how do they see the way that this is presented and that their narrative is told in the larger, whiter narrative of Australia?
Yeah, well, again, I mean, that's a huge question, in that there's no one sort of Asian Australian. In the book, I focus on Chinese Australians in particular because they've got the longest history, in terms of the longest recorded history of an Asian community group in Australia. It's a really interesting story, because from the gold rushes, so the, you know, the mid-19th century, through the White Australia period, Australians of Chinese extraction were travelling back to China, back and forth, in a really sort of cosmopolitan way. But of course, the Chinese Revolution in 1949, the White Australia policy, Australian non-diplomatic recognition of China, all served to stem that a little bit. But a lot of those connections restarted again after the restrictions were lifted.
So what it stemmed was the interchange. Now, it's interesting because something very similar happened in Indonesia, actually, in the 12th century, when there was a sort of moratorium on, well, no, the Chinese emperor banned foreign trade because they wanted to monopolize a certain amount. And so all of the Chinese traders who were along the north coast of Java at that time couldn't go home for fear of arrest. And so they sort of embedded themselves along that north coast and embedded themselves in, they all married Javanese wives because they couldn't import their Chinese wives, which would have naturally been the next step. But when that interchange, which that back and forth, was cut off, and in fact it led to an indigenization of the Chinese population along the north coast of China. So the Chinese population in Indonesia is essentially split into two types. The families that were deeply indigenized into married with Javanese particularly, and the newcomers that came as laborers mostly, and lived a very much ethnic Chinese life, a bit like Australians going to Bali. You know, yeah, there are the hippy-dippy travellers among the 900,000 Australians who'll go to Indonesia this year. Some will go and explore and really get to know. And, you know, and some of them will go and drink Foster's with other Australians and watch, you know, Aussie Rules on telly, right?
Yeah.
And it's been a bit the same. The story of Chinese migration to Indonesia is actually rather similar.
And none of them in my book would have been to Indonesia. I'm getting people asking me questions about whether or not I've been to Bali. The answer to that is no. Therefore, I can remain on my high horse and remain totally ignorant of whatever it is I'm sounding off about. The relevant books are Visiting the Neighbours, Australians in Asia, and it is written by Dr. Agnieszka Sobczyńska, my guest in the drawing room, Deputy Director of the National Centre for Australian Studies, and Indonesia, Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation, which is authored by Elizabeth Persani. And Elizabeth is giving a talk which is called Corruption Makes the World Go Round at the Sydney Opera House. It's happening this Saturday and it's part of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. That's it for RN Drive and the Drawing Room. We'll be back at 6 o'clock tomorrow, and you'd better be too.